Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from Abraham Lincoln: better remain silent and be thought a fool than to speak out and remove all doubt. Well, I'm not sure that's the best quote for a talk show host here, David. let me toss a couple of my favorites in for the day here. Franklin Roosevelt: conservative is a man who has two perfectly good legs, who, however, has never learned how to walk forward. And George Washington: as mankind becomes more liberal, they will be more apt to allow that all those who conduct themselves as worthy members of the community are equally entitled to the protections of civil government. I hope ever to see America among the foremost nations of justice and liberality. One of the protections of civil government that George Washington suggests all worthy members of the community should be equally entitled to is, in the minds of a lot of people these days, access to the Internet. Unfettered access to the Internet, uncontrolled by corporate interests. David Tebow is with us. He's with CNSNews.com, the conservative cybercast news service, CNSNews.com, their website. And, David, I've been getting emails from what seem to me to be AstroTurf groups saying, protect our Internet from government regulation. But you look at them, and it's just got AT&T's fingerprints all over it. What am I missing here?
What are you missing about control of the Internet?
Well, first of all, I'm assuming that I'm right, that these conservative, end quote, groups that are saying, that are opposed to net neutrality and saying, you know, keep the government out of control of the Internet, really what they don't want is they don't want the government controlling AT&T, right?
This issue is going to be decided on whether you believe in the free market. And whether you believe that the government ultimately needs to regulate it, because not only is it a free market, but the abundance of smut and filth on the Internet needs to be regulated.
Okay, well, these two separate issues here. Let's take the second one first, just because I think we can dispose of it very quickly. There's a guy who has proposed a .xxx domain. And his suggestion is, and this is a free market solution, actually. He wants to make money on this thing. And his solution is, just require by law, anything that's pornographic has to be in .xxx. And that way, it'll be very easy to filter. Public libraries can say, sorry, you can't go there. It'll be just like the movies. You know, you're under 17, you can't get in.
Mm-hmm.
And that just seems to me like a reasonable thing. I can turn him down. But I think that that's a good idea. I'm assuming you agree with me on that.
Yeah, and you know, you've got a very liberal Democrat, Ed Markey, proposing this legislation, the Network Neutrality Act of 2006. So, you know, I think that this is an issue that isn't going to necessarily be split along conservative and liberal lines, but it's going to be split along the lines of people who are absolutely 100% free market and people who believe that in some cases, some circumstances, you need some regulation.
So let's get back to that issue then. Because, you know, as I said, I think that pornography versus free market are really, we need to separate those two issues. And we can agree that one way to deal with pornography is simply to establish a domain that it all has to go to.
Right.
And that's something that, you know, I think progressives and conservatives can agree on. But the issue really is, in fact, let me just give you a little background. Back in the 80s, I used to run a bunch of forums for CompuServe. And this was back when CompuServe was owned by the big tax company, H&R Block, and based out of Columbus, Ohio. And, you know, we'd go to these annual meetings. And I remember the annual meeting that we went to, one of the ones where they introduced HTML. And they said, this is going to revolutionize, you know, there's this thing called the Internet, right? or the World Wide Web. You know, because at that point, there was the Internet, but there wasn't the World Wide Web. There was the Internet, and there was CompuServe, and there was AOL, and Lexis and Nexus and things like that. And you had to be a geek to use it. And I was one of those geeks using it. This was in the mid-80s. And then the web came along. And I remember one of the meetings that I was at in toward the late 90s where they said, we have the ability. Now, this was after AOL took over CompuServe. Might have been the early 90s. They said, we have the ability with our switches to set it up so if somebody's accessing the web through their AOL account, that we can cause a page to load from some, depending on the domain name server, from some, you know, locations, really fast or really slow. And it has nothing to do with how fast or slow it would normally load. We can simply control that. And so we can go to Disney, for example, and say, hey, you guys pay us $100,000 a year, and we'll have your pages load faster than anybody else's. And there was a debate within the company about that, and I was part of that debate. And ultimately, they decided not to do it because the blowback from consumers would be so heavy. That's basically what this is all about. Net neutrality. Basically, what's happened is AT&T and Verizon, a couple of companies, by coincidence of the nature of the communications infrastructure in the United States, most of which is going through public rights of way, and by coincidence of the existence of the Internet, which was brought into existence by the government, we have these two things that are very much part of the public. And now you've got private corporations saying, oh, we want to control that. You have AT&T saying, we should be able to do like that conversation that we had back 15 years ago. We should be able to say, oh, well, if Disney pays us $1 million a year, we'll make sure that their pages load lickety-split. And if CNS News doesn't, then your pages are going to take 2.5 seconds to load.
Right.
And why are the conservatives saying this is how it should be, this is the free market? This isn't a free market. Because this got nothing to do with the free market. AT&T owns the pipes.
It all comes down to politics, Tom. And you know that everything with regard to Internet access, broadband, speed is going to come back to the political message that every website, or the cultural message that every website distributes. You know, it's not a neutral issue. Let's face it, net neutrality is not a neutral issue.
Oh, wait a second.
Let's
split these issues up here, David, because perhaps either I'm missing something or you're missing something, because it seems to me that our understanding of this agreement of this issue is not an agreement, and I don't think that we can take positions on it unless we agree on what we're talking about. There, the ability of an Internet service provider to charge, for example, my website, TomHartmann.com, I'm
right.
charged based on the amount of stuff I have sitting on their servers. I'm charged based on how much of that stuff gets streamed out to the world. You know, people are downloading a lot of video. It's going
right.
to cost me more money. If somebody hooks up to the web and they want to watch, you know, video content or whatever, you know, if they're taking it off Usenet, for example, you know, there's providers that charge by the gigabyte. Some of your broadband providers right now, some of your cable providers and DSL providers are starting to say, okay, you can have up to, you know, 30 gigs a month or whatever, but after that, you're going to have to pay extra. I have no problem with any of that, because that all has to do with basically the more you're using the service, the more you're going to pay for it. But in the middle, there are these major giant pipelines that are an infrastructure that was put there by government, that was built by government. It happens to be administered right now by private companies. But this website infrastructure came about as a consequence of government activity. And AT&T wants to be able to say, because they own that infrastructure in the middle,
right,
that at the level of the highways, they can discriminate. It's like being able to say, okay, we're going to privatize a freeway. We're going to privatize Route 80 going across the United States. But anybody who drives a Volkswagen,
right,
we're going to put a device on their wheel that causes their car to go 10 miles an hour slower than everybody else.
Well, I think that we are understanding the same issue, but I'm submitting to you, Tom, when you're talking about the reasons why they might discriminate. Let me ask you, do you think that there might be some possibility that they might discriminate against your website because of the content of your website?
No, I think this is all about money.
Well, they could
equally come against your website. I just don't think they're going to do that. I don't think they're going to go there.
Has Google discriminated with regard to the ads that it's willing to post? Has Yahoo discriminated with regard to the ads that it's been willing to post?
Well, those are all financial transactions. I mean, I have Google ads on my website, and I can say I don't want particular domains to show up.
I know that conservatives have been upset about both Google and Yahoo, even AOL.
Yeah, but we just have a minute here left, David. it sounds to me like you're not supportive of the conservative position that AT&T should control the web rather than we the people through the government.
I believe that the free market is going to have to determine it, but I
which is going to mean AT&T because they own the pipes.
If you own the pipes and you've done so legally, then I think you ought to have the right to control.
But they own the pipes by virtue of our giving that control to them. Shouldn't we be able to have some say in how those are used?
It's a good question. I think that that ultimately this is going to come down to content and not about speediness or about the hardware.
Interesting.
I think it's always going to be about content.
That's interesting. See, I having been inside the business, I just don't think so. But, well, we'll see how it shakes out. David, good talking with you. David Tebow, CNSNews.com. Have a great morning. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program. New decision from the Supreme Court. More on that right after this.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
It's too late to fight. It's too late to change. You may be wrong for all I know, but you may be right.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. The Tom Hartmann radio program, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. And occasionally a decent, clean election, free of the influence of a corporation and its voting machines. Okay, here's this case that just came down before the Supreme Court. And the, trying to find the title of the case. I had it, David. Thank you. Garcetti versus Ceballos. And in this case, the Supreme Court basically just said that 20 million public employees, 20 million employees of the United States do not have free speech rights to disclose the government's inner workings. This is, and it's interesting who ruled on this thing. It was, this is particularly interesting. All five of the, well, arguably, Kennedy is a conservative, but he's not a foaming-at-the-mouth conservative. But the five conservative Catholic members of the court, Kennedy, Scalia, Thomas, Alito, and Roberts, all ruled, essentially, that if a person in the practice of their job points out the wrongdoing, in this case, it was a deputy sheriff. It was a prosecutor. Excuse me. It was prosecutor Richard Cabellos was his name. This guy in Los Angeles. He was in the L.A. District Attorney's Office. And he wrote a memo in which he suggested that a county sheriff's deputy might have lied in order to get a search warrant. And as a result of his outing this county sheriff's deputy, Cabellos got trash. He according to his lawsuit, he was demoted and denied a promotion. And oddly, in this case, Garcetti versus Ceballos, the five conservative members of the court, Scalia, Thomas, Alito, Roberts, and Kennedy, argued that The First Amendment doesn't apply. You don't have First Amendment protections. You don't even have whistleblower protections when you're doing your official duty. This is where it's really weird. If your job is to point out official wrongdoing, you have no protections when you do your job. No, I know it sounds totally wacko, but that's what... here it is. The court says, when public employees, this is, I'm reading from the decision, when public employees make statements pursuant to their official duties, the employees are not speaking as citizens for First Amendment purposes, and therefore the Constitution does not insulate their communication from employer discipline. Now, on the other hand, the court appears to have said that if your job is not to catch wrongdoing and you point out wrongdoing, you may still have some protections. And Justice Kennedy, he calls this a doctrinal anomaly. And he says, employees who make public statements outside the course of performing their official duties retain some possibility of First Amendment protection because that is the kind of activity engaged in by citizens who do not work for the government. He talks about this is the same thing as writing a letter to the editor of a local newspaper. He also says, if a government employer is troubled by this perceived anomaly, it has the means at hand to avoid it. A public employer that wishes to encourage its employees to voice concerns privately retains the option of instituting internal policies and procedures that are receptive to employee criticism. In other words, a government agency can basically say, okay, we're going to have somebody, and this is my read of this, and this is really early, and I'm not a lawyer, okay, but this is my take on this thing. What they're saying is that a government agency can have within it somebody whose job is to make sure that the government agency is not corrupt. And if they point that out, the government then has the right to say, okay, we're going to can your butt for that. You're going to be in trouble for having done your job because we really don't like what you said. This is the dream decision for the Bush administration. So you've got, the attorney general's, well, not even the attorney general. You've got one of the congressional oversight arms. You've got one of the internal oversight arms. Any kind of oversight of government. Anybody who's doing oversight of government. The conservatives on the court have now said, if your job is oversight of government, catching wrongdoing, and you do it, you can be punished for that. It's absolutely bizarre. Now, this case was argued twice. The first time it was argued was when Justice O'Connor was on the bench, and apparently it was 5-4 the other way. And then she retired, and Justice Roberts, as Chief Justice, said, we're going to hear this again. And, only this time with me and with Alito and Scalia, and, we're going to hear this again. And now it's 5-4 the other way. This is in my opinion, this is the erosion of the right to a transparent government. This is, more power in the executive branch. We'll get back on a little bit more on that. A lot of other stuff in the news. I want to get back to net neutrality. Why are the con Christians against the .XXX domain? And more in just a minute. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I believe in love and I live my life according to you. But I choose to let the mystery be. Everybody's wondering why and where they all came from. Everybody's wondering about where they're going to go.
And welcome back. There you go, 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where reason is our lifestyle choice. I'm reading the dissent here by Justice Souter, joined with Justice Stevens and Justice Ginsburg. Against the decision that was just handed down by the five conservative members of the court, Kennedy, Roberts, Thomas, Scalia, and Alito, that if a public employee speaks, that they don't have First Amendment free speech protections. And if their job is catching malfeasance, bad actions, that they're not protected for that. And in the dissent, here Justice Souter, he starts out, the court holds that when public employees make statements pursuant to their official duties, the employees are not speaking as citizens for First Amendment purposes, and the Constitution does not insulate their communications from employer discipline. I respectfully disagree. I would hold that the private and public interests in addressing official wrongdoing and threats to health and safety can outweigh the government's stake in the efficient implementation of policy. See, what this comes down to is, do you want the trains to run on time, have the government nice and efficient, but no free speech? Which is the position that was taken by the five conservative members of the court. Or do you want to say, no, we would like to hear from people who are also public employees? And I think maybe we've found the thing that might have flipped this and caused the conservatives to go aggressively in this direction. And it might even have something in some small way to do with the fact that it's the Catholics, the five Catholics on the court who all voted for this. And that is that this may tie in somehow to abortion and education. In his dissent, Justice Souter writes, "This ostensible domain beyond the pale of the First Amendment," in other words, this area that they have carved out, where if you're a public employee and you're doing your job and you say something that your employer doesn't like, you can be harassed, you can be demoted, you can be fired, even though it's your job to say that. That's what he's talking about when he says this ostensible domain beyond the pale of the First Amendment. In other words, you don't have First Amendment rights. He says this ostensible domain beyond the pale of the First Amendment is spacious enough, right? It's big enough, to include even the teaching of a public university professor. And I have to hope that today's majority does not mean to imperil First Amendment protection of academic freedom in public colleges and universities whose teachers necessarily speak and write, quote, pursuant to official duties, end quote. This decision could be the first step in trying to shut down college professors like Ward Churchill, for example, who say things that the right doesn't like to hear. He goes on to, in his dissent, this is David Souter. Keep in mind, David Souter, the lifelong Republican appointed by George Bush's father to the Supreme Court. David Souter says, "Are prosecutors' discretionary statements about cases addressed to the press on the courthouse steps made pursuant to their official duties? Are government's nuclear scientists' complaints to their supervisors about a colleague's improper handling of radioactive materials made pursuant to their duties?" See, the reason he asks these questions is because if they are, then by pointing out, by, you know, a prosecutor saying something that somebody up above him in the food chain, in the power structure, the government power structure doesn't like, they can step on him. Nuclear scientist blowing the whistle, he can be stepped on. And in fact, this was a whistleblowing case. This was a case where a prosecuting attorney said that cop lied when he got that search warrant. And the power structure in L.A. County didn't like that, and they punished that prosecuting attorney. And he said, wait a minute, I've got a First Amendment right of free speech. I can say things without being punished in the workplace for them. And the Supreme Court just ruled today, 5-4 decision, the five conservatives on the court, voting as a block, ruled, no, sorry, you don't have a First Amendment right of free speech. So we have that on the table. Also, we have net neutrality on the table. You know, a lot of interesting things here. Let's take your calls, your thoughts on this. Rachel in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Rachel, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi, Tom. This is on the topic, I suppose, almost of net neutrality. I'm looking at a CNET report from May 12th of this month, and the headline says, "Adult Industry Welcomes .XXX Domain Rejection," and it goes on to describe that conservative lobbying groups headed by the Family Research Council, which incidentally is the conservative James Dobson group, lobbied heavily to get the XXX domain rejected against the wishes of Europe. Europe really wanted this XXX domain to keep pornography off Main Street.
Right.
So I wanted to ask your guest previously how he would explain away this lobbying effort by conservative groups.
Well, apparently he wouldn't. I mean, it seemed to me that David Tebow was in agreement with me on this, although I'm not absolutely certain It's but, you know, next time we get him on, you can give us a call and let him know. If you have a call, anytime, Rachel, you or any of our other listeners, if you have a specific question for one of our guests, be sure and let Dan know, who answers the phone there at Air America New York, that you have a question for the guest, and he'll, on the, my call screen software, he'll put Q for the guest or words to that effect. So, and sometimes we have guests who don't like to take questions from callers, but very often they will, and I think David probably more often than not would, so we'll pass those along. Rachel, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Phil in Tampa Bay, Florida. Hey, Phil.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, what's up?
Let me get off the... Listen, there's an issue here. You know how disenfranchised voters were prevented from voting in Florida elections here, mostly black folks and
yeah,
folks.
Not just Florida. Ken Blackwell threw 300,000 people off the voter rolls in Ohio just in time for the 2004 election.
Right. Well, ChoicePoint was the brilliant company that not only sold people's Social Security numbers and credit cards to hundreds and thousands or millions of people by mistake, gone unpunished for that. But ChoicePoint was supposed to go through this list, okay,
right,
or the state of Florida, to do a better job and not exclude people who are arrested for misdemeanors or whatever.
Actually, yeah, it was ChoicePoint that was doing it. But Catherine Harris, they came back and they said, okay, if we use the exact match criteria, you've got maybe 50 people that we're going to take off the list. And she said, well, loosen up the criteria then. Make it so that it's a similar name. Make it so it's a similar address. Make it, you know, an awful lot of this was not so much ChoicePoint's fault as it was Catherine Harris.
Okay, but
she was defining the criteria.
Yeah, she's not in state government. This is all on Jeb now.
Yeah.
Jeb says that...
Well, Catherine Harris was just doing what Jeb was telling her to do.
Right. Well, Jeb... Okay, but she's out of state government. Jeb Bush said that they were going to go through the list and correct it so that everybody could, who was entitled to vote,
right,
could
and in
vote.
Fact, by law, they were required to by in time for the 2004 election, and they didn't meet it.
Yeah. Well, bottom line is, he hasn't done it yet.
Yep, I know.
And if... He ought to be arrested for obstruction of justice.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Phil, at all. Not at all. And I got to move along. Dave in Cortland, New York. Hey, Dave.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Tom. I just listened to you about the Supreme Court, the decision, and I just see it as another stick used to beat down public safety unions.
You know, that would make a whole lot of sense, Dave.
Yeah.
This is the Garcetti case here.
You know, if I go out and speak on behalf of my union and say I don't have enough equipment for my guys, or if I say I don't have enough people to go on calls with my people.
Are you a firefighter?
You know, yeah, I am. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we constantly struggle with staffing and getting enough people on the fire ground early to make a difference in the fire.
Yeah.
And if I were to go to my taxpayers and say, you know, we wanted to add a couple of staff and the city didn't want me to do that, and I'm doing it on behalf of the union, I could see where they could come after me. And under this decision, I wouldn't have much of a leg to stand on.
Well, it seems, and again, this is just first blush, and I've read a piece of the decision, and I've read most of the dissent, and I've read a couple of commentaries on it. So with that caveat, and the fact that I'm not an attorney or a constitutional scholar, okay, so this is the layman's opinion.
Oh,
but it seems that what they're saying is that you would still have free speech rights, Dave, unless your job was to look for wrongdoing, or your job was to determine how much material you need for your firefighters. If your job was to determine how much material you need for your firefighters and you spoke out and said we need more material, then you could be punished, oddly enough.
Right. Yeah. So. Okay. Yeah, I'm not management, so I don't know if that would be in my job description. So.
Yeah. 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 It's a very bizarre one. This is a decision that just, from my point of view, just seems to be spinning hard to the right, very, very hard to the right. Ron in Bennington, Vermont. Hey, Ron, we have about a half a minute left.
I was calling just to, it's awful the way the Supreme Court is so, so far to the right. I mean, it's not just this here decision. It's basically the Supreme Court who installed George Bush, and they recently passed this law that says if you become a handicap that you're still required to allow your fixed income of disability pay back student loans, and they're just like their decisions is extremely right.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that what we're looking at, Ron, thank you very much for the call and for the point. I think that we're looking at the 1905 court all over again, the Lochner court. In 1905, there was this case, it was called the Lochner case, that involved bakers in New York. And, well, I'll tell you about it after the break. I think this is the same kind of turning point. 45 minutes past the hour.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea. Our government gives a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here on the program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance, no way. 1-866-440-8466-440-THOM, our telephone number, toll-free all across the United States. Will in Orange County, California. Hey, Will.
Hey, Truth Teller, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Will. What's up?
Really cool. I had a quick question. Well, I don't know how quick. I was wondering, is there any laws that are in place, or is there any way we would have the ability to go ahead and change this stuff that they're throwing into place? It's like they're finally throwing in the last couple of cards of their stacked deck for the next generation of screwing up.
Okay. Sorry, Will. And we can't use language like that on the radio. The bottom line, though, let me get back to the Lochner decision, the Lochner court. This 1905 decision. In 1905, there was a case the bread makers had a law. They actually got a law passed in the state of New York that said that you couldn't work more than 10 hours a day, 5 days a week making bread. And it was a way of trying to limit the amount of labor available for the marketplace so that the price of labor would go up. And it was the law. And in 1905, it went before the Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court had upheld it. It went before the United States Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, this is an illegal interference in a contract between an employer and an employee. And therefore, any law that says that there's a maximum number of hours a person can work, or a minimum wage. I mean, that wasn't specifically part of Lochner. It came a little bit later. But or limits on child labor, limits on number of days that can be worked, limits, any kind of limits at all are unconstitutional. And from 1905 to 1937, you basically had what's sometimes referred to as the Lochner Court. You had this court that was making these extreme right-wing decisions. And it wasn't until after Franklin Roosevelt had been in office for, 4 years, 5 years, 1937, 32 to 37, or 33, 4, 5, 6, 7, yeah, 4 years, that the court changed and started agreeing with Roosevelt and started going along with the will of the people and saying, okay, well, I guess unions are okay. Okay, I guess it's okay to have, you know, maximum hour laws and all that kind of thing. And it just, that's what it took. And I think that we have just witnessed, with regard to the Supreme Court, we have just witnessed the first shot in the turning point. And the turning point being that we are moving back into the Lochner era. We're moving back to a right-wing Supreme Court, an extremist right-wing Supreme Court. Dave in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Dave.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just thinking that some of the language that you were saying in the decision of the majority on this case has far-reaching ramifications that may go even to some of the lawsuits regarding the NSA spying scandal and whether people have the right to challenge the government from positions within the government, and also even to challenge some of the national security letters that people are getting to silence their investigations.
Yes, if my reading of this is right, and not just mine, I mean, if the broad reading, I mean, there seems to be a consensus about what it means, and certainly the dissenters, the members of the Supreme Court, if their reading of the case is right, then it would seem that somebody whose official capacity was to find wrongdoing. In other words, if there's somebody inside the NSA whose job is to make sure that the NSA doesn't break the law, and there are lawyers inside the NSA who, for example, advised Michaels that he should not be doing the wiretap thing. If there are lawyers inside the NSA who are saying no, you shouldn't do it, and the NSA decides to punish them, they can do it now.
And the same thing would be true for a company like AT&T or Verizon that would fire an employee that questions them giving their information to the NSA without a warrant?
I don't know. This seems to be limited to public employees. Here's the actual phrase that the court used. When public employees, that's, you know, employees of government, make statements pursuant to their official duties, the employees are not speaking as citizens for First Amendment purposes, and the Constitution does not insulate their communications from employer discipline. That's the key sentence in the decision. So I don't think that this yet applies to private employees, but that'll come down the road.
Well, I'm concerned because I know a lot of national security letters going out to people that follow maybe news stories or people within and outside the government and private practice and private business that might be investigating or going into lines of reason that get into national security issues. And they're prevented from telling anybody they've even gotten the letter in the first place.
That's right.
And so I'm thinking that, if they were to challenge that and they were in a position within the government, that this new ruling would negate them being able to challenge it at all.
It may be. I'm not an expert on this stuff and I'm not an attorney. I don't know. But it's an interesting question to raise. And over the next 24 hours, I'm sure that a lot of these questions will be answered. Dave, got to move along. Thank you for the call. Tom in Buffalo. Hey, Tom, we have a little less than a minute to go. What's up?
I was just talking and thinking that maybe this is a way to silence the unions at a local level. Because
the public employee unions, I would think, yes.
Yeah, well, exactly. The public employee unions like police and firefighters. Yeah. Who else speaks out on matters of public safety and health if it's not the local union leaders? Other than people that are hired to watch for wrongdoing and oversight of different departments, the local unions at that level are the ones that really have more to say about public safety and health than anyone else. And
yeah.
If you silence them and the manning and the staffing for police and fire, I believe that, like that my brother firefighter from Cortland, I believe that he is right, that they're trying to silence the rank-and-file
yeah.
firefighters.
I don't disagree with you, Tom. And if they don't do it with this decision, they'll figure out another way to do it. This is what I said about Sam Alito when he was first being interviewed. Over and over and over again, Sam Alito, in answer to the questions when he was being interviewed. And you saw the same thing with John Roberts. These guys, having grown up being, you know, privileged, white, rich guys, have no sense of what it's like to see a cop car down the street and feel your heart drop. To worry about somebody from the government breaking into your home or listening in your phone conversation. They just have no sense of what it's like to be a minority in the United States, a significant, an oppressed minority. They have no sense of what it's like to be somebody who may be a victim of government power. Not an enemy, but a victim. They have no sense. Eric Bowler coming up next on how the news media failed to be a watchdog.
Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. Eric Bollard is with us. He's the author of a new book, Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for George W. Bush, or for Bush. Get the title correct. Hey, Eric, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So you start out the book by talking about how Bob Woodward, for example, has become one of the heroes, role models for the Washington Press Corps. And for 2 years, he sat on the Valerie Plame story and didn't say a word because it would have looked bad for Bush. He sucks up to Bush in order to get enough information that he can write a Bush-friendly book because it'll make him another $1 million. What's going on?
Well, I thought that was the reason I let off the book. I thought it was just such a sort of symbolic, stunning change from sort of watchdog to lapdog. I mean, here's Woodward, who came to fame in the 70s, literally bringing down a Republican administration with Bernstein. Just sort of dogged, aggressive reporting and sort of the old cliche, leaving no stone unturned and getting all these outside sources and doing the work that the establishment press at the time, when you think back of the Watergate break-in in 72, didn't really pay much attention to. They saw a story, they kept going after it. And here he is during the Valerie Plame investigation, you know, what clearly became the most important criminal investigation of the Bush administration. And he got a tip early on about Valerie Plame. He got a leak that like the other reporters that eventually got hauled into court, and he just sat on it. You know, he didn't tell his editors, he didn't tell anyone. I mean, this case ends up at the Supreme Court because it involves all sorts of questions about subpoenaing reporters. Doesn't say a word. But when he does go on TV, he goes on to mock and ridicule the entire prosecution, the special prosecutor, saying it was essentially of a waste of time. And then finally we find out after Scooter Libby's indicted, oh, by the way, I got the same scoop everyone else did. I mean, it's just on so many different levels. It was just sort of the ultimate example of what sort of has gone seriously wrong with the D.C. press corps and how it just sort of stood down for Bush.
And yet Woodward himself is still treated as a credible figure. In fact, they, by and large, they don't often interview his former writing partner, Carl Bernstein, because Bernstein is willing to speak the truth about the Bush administration.
Well, yeah, Bernstein and Woodward had drastically different notions. I mean, he early on, Bernstein was on the record saying the Valley Plain was a big deal. I remember reading somewhere as the case was unfolding, him and Woodward were together for some, Watergate function, anniversary function. And they got into this argument, Bernstein saying, this is a big deal, this is a big deal. I don't think Bernstein knew Woodward was sitting on this scoop. And Woodward was saying, oh, you know, you'll see in the end, it'll all be nothing. And obviously Carl was right, and Woodward, I think, really, I think did permanent damage to his reputation, just as the D.C. press corps has done permanent damage to its reputation in the last 5 or 6 years.
Sort of. I mean, they're the ones who define their reputations, aren't they? I mean, outside of people like you.
Well, yeah, I know. I think if you ask them, they're doing a great job, and everyone's patting each other on the back. But, no, I think anyone who takes a step back and particularly looks at what this same press corps did to the Bush, during the Clinton years, long before Monica Lewinsky showed up, just going after, you know, Whitewater and Travelgate and Clinton supposedly, trading secrets to China for campaign funds. I mean, they couldn't stop writing these types of stories. They couldn't wait to get to work in the morning to really go after the Clinton White House and to see how they've laid down for the Bush White House. So, yeah, inside the bubble, I think they all think they're doing a great job. Anyone with any sort of distance or perspective, I think, would admit something has gone seriously wrong in the last 5 or 6 years.
To what extent, Eric Bullard, author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, to what extent do you think that the press was so excited to go after every little thing with Bill Clinton? Oh, he fired a travel agent. It's Travelgate! That kind of thing. I mean, these huge investigations, these big hoop-de-doops around what turned out to be nothing and was pretty obviously nothing right from the get-go. And yet you have Bush, who literally has lied us into a war, and there's an abundance of evidence. I mean, our local newspaper here, the Oregonian, did not even cover the Downing Street minutes for a week. I mean, it's like, you know, national newspapers not even talking about the Downing Street memo and things like this. Why is it that the press has rolled over for Bush when they went after Clinton?
Well, I think the biggest argument or the biggest explanation is just this fear of this liberal bias charge that's been so effective and produced such benefits for conservatives on the right who have been making this charge for 30 years. And I think it sticks, and I think journalists have real rabbit ears. So during the 90s, how do you prove you're not liberal? You just pound the Clinton White House endlessly over stories, as we said, that turned out to be nothing. I mean, the New York Times created Whitewater out of whole cloth and chased it for 3-4 years. And during the Bush years, how do you prove you're not liberal? Well, you sort of look the other way, and you sort of, you know, talk. When you go on TV, you talk about, you know, the White House's amazing message discipline and how charming Bush is. And you remember during the 2000 campaign, the entire litmus test for the Beltway press was who would you rather have a beer with during the 2000 campaign? Well, it's Bush, so therefore he must be, you know, he'd be a better candidate. So I think there's just been a titanic shift in what's happened, and I think a lot of it has to do with being spooked by this liberal bias charge and folks understanding the best way to do that is you go after Democrats, you sort of lay down for Bush.
So we're seeing the fulfillment of the work the refs, Lee Atwater's strategy, work the refs.
Oh, absolutely. And I think what I detail in the book is, you know, Lee Atwater was considered hardball for his time. He wanted to work the refs. But really on the conservative on the right, particularly the blogs, people like Michelle Malkin, people like Powerline, Little Green Footballs, I mean, these are people who aren't trying to work the refs, as I say in the book. I mean, these are people who want to drag the refs behind the alley and bludgeon them. I mean, the criticism from the right is really coming from people who sort of despise the press and want to dismantle the press and want to delegitimize the press. And unfortunately, I think the mainstream press, is, as I said, sort of spooked by those charges. And instead of dismissing those conservative critics as sort of radicals, they internalize it and go out of their way to prove that, you know, they don't have a liberal bias.
So you talk in the book, we're talking with Eric Bullard, he's the author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush. And you point out that Bush couldn't have sold the war in Iraq in 2002, 2003 if the press had been, frankly, doing its job. I mean, this is not a small thing.
No, yeah. I mean, Daniel Okrin, who was the first New York Times public editor ombudsman earlier this year, was giving a talk at, I think it was Williams College, and he said, essentially, the American press led this country into war. I mean, you cannot...
It wasn't just Judy Miller.
No, I mean, it was the press corps. And you're right. I mean, what could be... That's such an awesome responsibility, and in this case, it was such an awesome failure. But yeah, I do argue in the book that even after 9/11, the administration's attempt to sell an unprecedented preemptive war against Iraq, which had not attacked its neighbors and had not attacked the U.S. or any of its allies. I mean, that's
at least since 1991.
Yeah, I mean, even after 9/11, that is not an easy argument to make to take the country into war. And I think, you know, I counted something like 28 pro-war editorials in the Washington Post in the 6 months before the war. You know, key, you know, so-called liberal reporters and columnists.
Yeah.
At, you know, places like the Newsweek and Time and the New Yorker. I mean, that so-called liberal media establishment
doesn't exist.
They were on that bandwagon.
Yeah. The liberal media is the nation in this radio program. I mean,
yeah.
There's just not much more out there. Eric Bollert, author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush. You have a chapter in here about the battle for public broadcasting.
Yeah.
What a lot of people are now starting to refer to as national Republican broadcasting.
Right. Yeah. The reason I put that in there is most of the book is about how the press covered certain issues and how they fell down. I think the press did a pretty good job covering the battle over PBS. Ken Tomlinson was sort of a Republican crony who put in over what's called the CPB, with hands out over a lot of the money. And he decided to launch this crusade over public broadcasting, how it had a liberal bias. And the reason it was so important, I think, and the reason I spent a whole chapter in the book, it really was an insight to the conservative thinking. This is how they'd like to treat all the press. Mm-hmm. Which is to put them on notice and make them fear. Obviously, public broadcasting feared it because they knew that some of their funding could be withdrew. But anyway, Tomlinson launched this crusade in the press about liberal bias. You know, he essentially drove Bill Moyers off the air. Now,
yeah.
What no one really talked about was PBS and CPB did 2 years' worth of polling to find out what Americans felt. Both PBS viewers and people who did watch it. These weren't just, you know, the lefty Birkenstock wearing folks. Americans in general, almost a tiny percentage thought public broadcasting had any sort of liberal bias. And most of those were just self-identified conservatives who thought all media had a liberal bias. So Tomlinson did extraordinary damage to public broadcasting. And with the support of the White House and Karl Rove, he really tried to drive a stake through public broadcasting.
Yeah, and to a large extent has, in my opinion. Eric Bollert, the author of the book Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush. Eric, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. After the break, an update from the belly of the beast with the Talk Radio News Service. Be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, friends, 21 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio, Victoria Jones with us on the air from Washington, D.C., deep inside the belly of the beast there, the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I am actually in the belly today. I'm actually in the basement of the White House.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
Now, are you familiar with the Supreme Court decision that just came down?
This is the one about freedom of speech, right, or lack of it.
Right, the one that says that basically if you work for a public institution and you say something that your boss doesn't like, even if it's your job to find public corruption, you can still be fired.
That's pretty much how I read it, and I'm not a lawyer, so it was a bit chilling to me, and that wonderful new Justice Alito seems to have cast the deciding vote.
Yes.
Doing exactly what he was hired to do then.
That's right. And of course, Roberts deciding to re-argue the case after it had been argued in front of Sandra Day O'Connor, who was inclined to vote against it. And so Roberts also, I mean, it's basically, it's interesting. The five most conservative members of the court and the five Catholics on the court were arguing this. And I point out the fact that they're Catholics, not as some sort of a anti-Catholic thing, but because in one of the dissents, and I believe it was Souter's dissent, he said this same principle, I'm paraphrasing wildly now, I don't have it right in front of me, I read it on the air in the last hour, but he said basically this same principle could be applied to a teacher in a public university. And so if you had a public university, you had a teacher who was saying things that you didn't particularly like, or that the university provost didn't like or whatever. In other words, this allows you to get rid of Ward Churchill.
Well, this is very, very disturbing, and, you know, this is clearly something that the administration is going to be jumping up and down about. I can tell you there were no questions asked about it in the briefing today, but I think that's partly because people are genuinely trying to absorb it and understand it before they ask questions.
Yeah. Now, George W. Bush, it's interesting, the Dow's down over 100 points right now, and which isn't exactly a statement of confidence about the, you know, the Bush administration. But I don't think today's drop in the Dow has anything to do with Henry Paulson. But isn't it interesting that in order to replace Jon Snow, a guy, by the way, who is worth about $125 million, they've found a guy who's worth $500 million, Paulson. But so we have 100 millionaire being replaced by another 100 millionaire. But that doesn't disqualify somebody. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, good and intelligent people. And in fact, case in point, it may be that Henry Paulson is a good and intelligent guy. Here's a guy who is outspoken that the United States, in order to be economically competitive, should have signed the Kyoto Agreement, and has come out and said the Bush administration is wrong. I mean, Bush has to reach out and get somebody who disagrees with him.
Well, we were told in the briefing that the president has no problem at all with people who disagree with him, and that, you know, that Tony Snow told us that he goes to these various meetings, and that it's a free and full discussion, and that people who do disagree with the president feel free to air their views.
You know what it is, Victoria?
What?
They've changed his meds. I mean, when you see that kind of a personality change in this short a period of time, they've changed his meds.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, what else could it be? Bush will tolerate dissent after an entire lifetime of not tolerating dissent?
That's what we're told by Tony Snow. But I don't know how senior the meetings are that he gets into.
Yeah, that's
you know, right. I don't really know. Also, something else very interesting about all this, which is that we were told that May the 20th is the day that Paulson and the president met, and that's the day that he was basically offered the job, and the 21st was the day that he accepted it, and then, of course, all the clearances went through. Well, on May the 25th, which was last Thursday, when the president held his joint press availability with Prime Minister Blair, he said that he and Jon Snow, had not discussed resignation. Well, Paulson was offered the job on the 20th, and on the 25th, he says that he and Snow had not discussed resignation. Now,
this is just what a facile liar he is.
Well, Tony Snow says that this is because they didn't want to announce it at the time of the 20th because they didn't want before he was like confirmed by his background check, because they didn't want the markets to be worried for 4 or 5 days.
Right, but you know, come on,
it sounds like he didn't tell us the truth last night.
No, he didn't.
Tonight.
You want to hear the world's shortest George Bush joke?
Go on.
George Bush called today. Hello, he lied. Okay, so we have a minute or so left before we have to take a break. What else is happening in Washington, D.C., Victoria?
Well, that is, frankly, the big story. On Haditha, it's interesting that we're trying to find out what the president knew and when did he know it, which is always...
This is about the Marine massacre, the massacre by the Marines of civilians in Iraq.
That's right, the massacre by Marines of what seems to be about 24 civilians in Iraq. Now, we're told that a reporter from Time contacted the president and started asking questions about this, and then Steve Hadley, National Security Advisor, briefed the president. So my question was, I laid out that scenario and then said, so did he then brief the president because Time called and asked those questions, or did he brief the president because it was already scheduled that he was going to brief the president on this issue?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Tony Snow didn't know. and we'll get back to me. But that seems to me to be important. I mean, was it, in fact, even on the radar for the president to be told about this?
Yeah, you would certainly think so. You would certainly think so.
And yet I'm not sure that it was.
Okay. Victoria Jones, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you very much.
Great talking with you today. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466, toll-free all across the United States. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com and click the live chat link up at the top of the page. Or you can go to knightstemplar.com and click the live chat link up at the top of the page. Dave in Eureka, California. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Oh, Tom, I was reacting to your guest there, Eric, because the thought in my head, you and your listeners are very much aware of the amount of harm this administration is doing to this country. Are the press unaware of that? Are they aware that by kicking back and not saying anything, they are a part of that harm?
I suspect that there are very few people in the press, at least at the level of interaction with the public, who are thinking about much more than their healthy mid-six-figure salary, Dave, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, these guys, they get into, they're making $200,000, $300,000, $500,000 a year, something like that. You know, folks who are on national television, you know, the White House correspondent for the big networks. And then, of course, you know, you get the anchors. I mean, Katie Couric, what, $14 million? And I really think that at that point in time, and this is the big transition, you know, at that point in time, they're really thinking more about the money that they're getting and the stardom that they have than they are about what their impact on the country is going to be. Walter Cronkite was, you know, in his career, most of his career, made the equivalent of, in today's dollars, probably around $60,000 or $70,000 a year. I think his salary the last year that he was at CBS was something like $38,000 a year. I mean, it was not huge. And that was back when news was a money-losing part of network operations. They only had it because radio and television stations had to carry news in order to fulfill the public service obligations of the Fairness Doctrine, which Reagan set aside in 1987, and then Clinton drove a stake through in 1996 when he signed the Telecommunications Act. And so now we no longer have news that is required to be news. It's no longer even required to be carried by radio and television stations. Many don't even carry any. And the consequence is that news has become entertainment, and that the people in the news business think of themselves as stars and entertainers, and they're really concerned about, you know, how does their hair look, how much money are they going to get, and how are they doing climbing the corporate ladder. And until we say, hey, wait a minute, the public airwaves are our public airwaves, and even the cable lines go through our public rights of way. You couldn't have cable TV without we the people saying, yes, you can use our public spaces, our roads, our public rights of way to bury your cable lines. If cable lines had to run entirely on private property, they couldn't exist. And at some point, we the people have to say, enough already. The cable lines, the satellite lines, the TV lines, the television and radio, it is the property of we the people. And we do think that democracy is important, and you can't have democracy without an educated populace, at least about politics and civics and things like that. And just, you know, take it back and go back to that. Dave, thanks for the call. It's always nice to hear from you. Joseph in Fort Lewis, Washington. Hey, Joseph.
Hi, how you doing, Tom? Glad to talk to you.
Thank you for calling.
I just wanted to call because I'm frankly a little bit concerned about some of the things that are going on today, what with the president's interjection in the lawsuits that are being taken up against the phone companies, saying that for reasons of national security, he doesn't want these lawsuits to go through.
Well, and on May 5th, he signed the presidential order that said that publicly traded companies no longer have to comply with SEC rules if they just happen to be part of the military-industrial complex.
Yeah, and also now with this this government whistleblower act saying that you can be punished if you speak out against something that it's your job. I think these are just small incremental steps that is going to give the president supreme power. And I think that if the American populace doesn't become wise of this, and you know, with the now more conservative media, it's going to be harder and harder for people to actually realize this is going on unless they educate themselves.
Yeah.
It's really going to become a problem, because I think these are just two steps in a line of many to come that are really going to be the downfall.
Yeah, spot on, Joseph. And I think thanks for the call. I think when people think of these guys, it's important to remember that Alito was the author years ago, decades ago, of the concept of signing statements for the president. And that John Roberts' job in 2000, that he took a leave of absence from his highly paid multimillion-dollar gig as a corporate lawyer and went down to Florida, because he used to be a clerk for Justice Rehnquist, went down to Florida during the elections in 2000 and coached James Baker III's lawyers, George W. Bush's lawyers, coached them in how to argue before Justice Rehnquist that the Supreme Court should take the Bush versus Gore lawsuit, where George Bush sued Al Gore to stop the count in Florida because, and go back and read it. You can just read this, Bush v. Gore, it's right there, because George Bush claimed in that lawsuit that if all the votes in the state of Florida were counted, it would cause irreparable harm to George W. Bush. I kid you not, that was the entire basis of the Bush v. Gore lawsuit. And I don't think that Rehnquist would have bought that if he hadn't had his former clerk putting together, crafting the argument for the lawyers who argued it in front of him, and his former clerk, John Roberts, who was well paid for that, very well paid by being given Rehnquist's old job. Dixie in Seattle. Hey, Dixie.
Yeah, I was going to say, the anthrax thing that happened, do you think that had a chilling effect on the press?
Yeah, I suspect it did. It probably scared the bejesus out of a whole bunch of them. Yeah.
And the same thing, of course, with Congress.
Yeah. Well, in particular, I mean, there were only two members of the United States Senate who were in a position to stop the Patriot Act, and that was Pat Leahy of Vermont, who was chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, or the Senate Judiciary Committee, rather, and Tom Daschle, who was the head of all the Democrats in the Senate and therefore was the head of the Senate, the president, the leader of the Senate. And both of them could have refused to let the Patriot Act either out of committee or before the full Senate for a vote. And both of them seemed to be inclined to do that, to not let the Patriot Act go forward. And those are the only two members out of the 535 members of Congress, the only two who received anthrax. And I don't, you know, it's too much of a coincidence for me. The odds against that have to be a zillion.
And even the press, the liberal press, is the ones that got it, too, seemed like.
That's right. Outside of Washington, D.C., there were a couple of media outlets.
I wonder, since that was a weapons-grade anthrax, it came out of someplace, the military.
Yeah, that's the speculation.
I wonder how come they haven't followed that up and never traced it down.
I think you just answered your own question, Dixie.
Mm.
Yeah. You shouldn't even call it a conspiracy. It's just like, well, here's what you can see.
I mean, it seems so obvious,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I agree. Dixie, thanks a lot for the call.
You,
I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Joseph in Orange County, New York. Hey, Joseph.
Hi, thank you. I think the Democrats lost the point that for the 2006 elections, the Republicans are corrupted, like, because the same corrupted I see on the William Jefferson scandal.
Oh, yeah. Name one Democrat for me that took money from Jack Abramoff, Joseph.
Yes, but...
just one.
They lost the point.
Just one name.
Just one man.
Give me the name of one Democrat who took money from Jack Abramoff.
Oh, you said only Republicans.
Only Republicans.
You said only Republicans, but one Democrat's for me enough.
Yeah, but name one. Name one Democrat who took money from Jack Abramoff.
How many Republicans are?
20, 30, something like that.
Wow. Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. Bonnie in Burgistown, Pennsylvania. Hey, I love it. I think the RNC must pay these guys to, you know. Let's get a phone bank and just call all the talk shows and go, the Democrats are just the same as Republicans, you know.
Yeah.
Bonnie, what's up?
As an addendum to your discussion about how the broadcast personalities are paid, there's also the fact that they don't really study journalism anymore. They take communications. But I called right. about, I think the goal of the neocons is to privatize the public broadcasting system. They tried to do that here. First they starve it with fewer funds, and then they make it more and more conservative. And people like Mara Liasson are on there, so more and more people who contribute don't contribute. But anyway, what they did between 1995 and like 2002 here was there was a Pittsburgh nonprofit public broadcasting group and PaxNet and a right-wing religious broadcaster, they began the process of privatizing the smaller of our two public TV stations. And they eventually won, even though there was huge public dissent, and we were able to get the right-wing religious broadcaster out of there. But they won, and now we have a 24-hour home shopping network there instead of a public broadcasting system. So on that particular station. So we still have one station. But I think the goal is to weaken it and then sell it off because those licensures are so valuable. Sure. And they would not only destroy public broadcasting, they would also be able to give those licensures to their big contributors at fire sale prices.
Yeah, and it's all in the name of the free market. And when they see free market, what they're really talking about is the interests of the wealthy and powerful over democracy. And it's not just, this isn't about class warfare, like, you know, people with money are bad or something like that. It's not by any stretch of the imagination do I mean to suggest or imply that. But there is a dynamic, there is a conflict between aggregated wealth, the power of aggregated wealth, particularly in the corporate form, and democracy itself. And that's why traditionally we've said there have to be institutions, and thank you, by the way, Bonnie, for the call. There have to be institutions or systems to balance that tension. That tension actually can be a good thing for democracy. But when the systems that balance it are gone, then it's not a good thing for democracy. And ultimately, it's not a good thing for wealth either. It's not good for people of wealth or for corporations. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Lather was 30 years old today. They took away all of his toys.
And put him in charge of Park and Oil.
There was Howard C. Green, just turned 33. His leather chair waits at the bank. And Sergeant Dow Jones, 27 years old, commanding his very own tank.
But Lather, they sent him down to...
Nice thing to do.
Yes, they sent him down to Alabama to work on a political campaign.
Drawing pictures of mountains that look like bumps and thrashing the air with his hands.
Why is it that I can't listen to that song? It is Grace Slick, the Jefferson Airplane, Lather, from what? It must have been the early 70s, without thinking of George W. Bush. It's, I'm sorry. And a sign that the Bush administration intends to ratchet up its program of domestic surveillance, the Central Intelligence Agency today announced that it was offering what it called a friends and family eavesdropping plan. Under the new plan, American citizens would reap significant long-distance discounts on their calls in exchange for permitting the CIA to listen in on all of their conversations. This is from Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. The calls will be routed through a CIA spy satellite and then beamed back to the spy agency's headquarters in Langley, Virginia, where agency operators will be listening in on a 24-hour basis. With many Americans unhappy with their current long-distance service, the CIA hopes that consumers will decide that having a CIA agent listening in on all their conversations is a small price to pay for fewer dropped calls, which is what the CIA's eavesdropping plan promises. According to the agency's announcement, the CIA is sweetening the deal by offering even deeper discounts if the customer will allow the agency to out the names of its friends and family by leaking them to a newspaper reporter or columnist. Carol Foyler, 28, of Memphis, Tennessee, who signed up for the eavesdropping plan on Monday, said that so far she has mixed feelings about the new service. She said, I was talking to my boyfriend last night, and all of a sudden I heard Dick Cheney on the line. That kind of puts a damper on things. Indeed. Well, you know how these new strategies go. Yes. That, of course, Andy Borowitz, you know, he makes that stuff up. But here's stuff you couldn't make up. You just couldn't make it up. This from the Washington Post. David Fahrenthold and Zachary Goldfarb. A major figure in the Election Day phone jamming scandal. Remember this? Charles McGee, this guy, he had hired a phone bank to jam the phone banks of the Democrats' volunteers so that John Sununu could get elected to the Senate, because he was running against Gene Shaheen, who was the very popular Democratic governor of the state of New Hampshire, and it looked like she was going to win. And so the Republicans decided that they had to suppress the vote. They had to have fewer people voting. I mean, you've heard that before on this program, the famous Paul Weyrich comment about that.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government.
This is Paul Weyrich, the Republican consultant and some would say founder of the modern-day Republican movement, speaking in a church to a group of Christian Republicans.
They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Right from the lips of Paul Weyrich, the senior GOP strategist. And so, you know, following along those lines, Charles McGee said, yeah, well, we'll drive down the number of people voting. We'll just jam the phone lines here in New Hampshire and just, or there in New Hampshire, I guess. I used to live in New Hampshire, so yeah, flashback moment. Anyway, as he said, we'll just jam the phone lines. And so the local Democratic groups that are calling their voters and saying, hey, you know, do you want to ride? A lot of people were sitting around waiting for the ride. A lot of people were housebound, particularly retired folks, and calling up and saying, you want your ride? You know, we'll be able to pick you up at 2 o'clock or whatever. They had a phone bank going. They were going to call tens of thousands of people. And the Republicans jammed those lines by repeatedly calling and hanging up. It was a denial of service attack on the Democratic phone bank. And as a consequence of that, the Republican, John Sununu, won the race and became United States Senator from New Hampshire by just a squeaker of a margin. Probably about the margin that was provided by the phone banks being jammed by the Republicans. So Charles McGee actually got convicted of this. He got busted and convicted. This was just last year. He was given a 2.5-year sentence. He served 7 months. He just got out. So what is he doing now? This guy who's been convicted, he's admitted. He pled guilty to conspiracy, felony, served 7 months in prison. For jamming the lines of the Democratic Party and the unions associated with the Democratic Party? Well, the Republican political marketing firm that he used to work for when he did this, it's called Spectrum Monthly and Printing, Inc., has hired him back. And not only that, this company is putting together a school. It's called the GOP Campaign School for Republican candidates, teaching them how to win elections. He's going to teach the school. He's going to be available to... I kid you not. Here, right from the Washington Post. He's back at his old job with the Republican political marketing firm Spectrum Monthly and Printing, Inc., and he will be helping out at the firm's GOP campaign school for candidates. Richard Pease, the firm's co-president, said McGee would be available to advise candidates at the two-day event planned for next weekend in Manchester, New Hampshire. Only in the Republican Party, you know? I mean, only in the Republican Party. In the Democratic Party, you get, you know, Washington, or what's his name? Jefferson gets busted. And Nancy Pelosi comes out and says, step down. You know, get off that committee. But in the Republican Party, Tom DeLay gets busted. And what do? They change the composition of the ethics committee so he doesn't get challenged after 3 slaps on the wrist. Incredible. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be back after the news.
To the Tom Hartman program, check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Founded in 1990, Bioneers, a nonprofit organization that promotes practical environmental solutions and innovative social strategies for restoring the earth and communities. Their website, bioneers.org, and our Bioneers guest for the week, Kaya Winwood, is with us. Kaya Winwood, an executive leadership coach and organizational development consultant, and with the Rockwood Fund, the website rockwoodfund.org. Kaya, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
Am I pronouncing your name right?
You are, and you're actually pronouncing it just right. And it's the Rockwood Leadership Program.
Okay, the Rockwood Leadership Program. Thank you.
Part
of what you're doing, in fact, I guess the main focus of what you're doing, is training people for leadership positions in progressive movements. Is that a good way of saying it?
Well, actually, I would say these are folks who are either already in leadership or who are emerging leaders, but who have a strong progressive social change agenda.
Okay, so many of our listeners have a strong progressive social change agenda and may have at some point or may in the future think about taking on some sort of a leadership role, whether it be a community activist sort of thing, whether it be Stop a Walmart, whether it be something larger, whether it be political, whatever. What are the qualities within a person that you try to bring out, that you look for? What are the things that would tell you that this is a person who can do this sort of thing, and how can a person self-evaluate that, number one?
Mm-hmm.
And number two, then what's next? What do you do with it?
Okay. Well, you know, from my point of view, Tom, the first quality is authenticity. Can this person be trusted? And I don't mean in a smarmy way, but in a very rigorous, is this person consistent between what he or she says and what he or she does? And there's a certain amount of transparency that's involved in that. It's a movement from the heart as well as from the head. And I think that leaders in the past have led often through control and fear. And I think that today's leaders are being asked to be more collaborative, be certainly coming from a sense of purpose and commitment and compassion, for lack of a better word.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Well, these are important points, but they're also very general.
They are.
Say you're training me for leadership.
Okay.
Train me.
Okay. So first of all, I would say, okay, Tom, let's start from a place of why are you here? Why you in this time and in this place? Because I don't believe that there are any accidents. That using whatever kind of spiritual or lack thereof framework you want to use, I would want to say, well, why you?
Well, I can tell you, Kaya, I'm here because three years and 6 months ago, I was driving across the country back to Michigan, where I had worked in radio from 1968 to 1978,
mm-hmm.
and all we could get on the radio as my wife and I were driving back to my parents' home was right-wing talk radio, and I heard Sean Hannity go off on this rant about how he was at a Habitat for Humanity, and he was calling it Hannity for Humanity, and he said, no liberal's going to get this house that they were building.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, A, somebody has to be answering this stuff, and B, somebody could make some money doing that. And I wasn't thinking about my making money, but I was thinking that there was a way that this could be promoted to people who own radio stations as saying, hey, there is an unserved market here. You should be putting liberal programming on, because if there are people who want to listen to conservative programming, there are people who want to listen to liberal programming, and you can sell advertising and make money at it, and it can make money. And so I got home, I wrote a piece called Talking Back to Talk Radio, and published it on Common Dreams, and that became the beginning of the business plan for Air America Radio.
Okay.
Shelley and Anita Drobny picked it up, and then I decided to put my money where my mouth was, or whatever, it wasn't much money, and started doing this show on a local station in Burlington, Vermont, that we're still on, WVAA, on the weekends.
Right.
And then we took it to a network, the network picked it up, i.e. America Radio Network. They went out of business a year later when Air America came along, and now the show is syndicated by Air America. So
okay.
I'm here because I was so PO'd at Sean Hannity, and I wanted to speak back, and I want to take back my country.
Okay. So you've answered my question here. You haven't. There's a piece of me that wants to ask, there were probably a lot of folks driving on that freeway, maybe the car next to you, thinking, there's something wrong with this. But they weren't the ones who did it. You were. And so why you? What are you here to bring into the world? And you've answered some of it. But I think that each person has a gift to bring. And leadership is about recognizing, one, that we all have it, whatever that it is for each of us, and that we have a responsibility to bring it into the world. So you actually told us the story of how you brought it into the world, and I want to thank you for that. And so the question I would ask any of us, is what are you here to do, and what are you doing that is in alignment with that, and what are you doing that's not?
And do more of the former and less of the latter.
Exactly. We don't have time anymore for the kind of navel-gazing, I think, that we did in the 60s. I think it's time to really do some rigorous internal work and then manifest it out in the world.
How many, it's really easy, Kaya Windwood, rockwoodfund.org, the website.
Rockwood Leadership Program. So rockwoodleadership.org.
Rockwoodleadership.org. I'm sorry. I thought you meant the name was leadership. That's actually the URL.
No. URL is rockwoodleadership.org.
Okay, got it. Rockwoodleadership.org. It's really easy for this to devolve into a new age version of Dale Carnegie.
You're right.
Boosterism. And I don't mean that to put down Dale Carnegie, by the way, because I actually, when I was 20 years old, I took the Dale Carnegie course, and it was a really useful thing. I learned how to speak in public, which is something that I was not competent at before, and it was a skill set that I've found to be very useful in my life.
Right.
So and yet at the same time, there's also, a subset of folks in progressive communities and in progressive spiritual community, right across the board, who have taken the more superficial aspects of it and elevated them, and it seems like it's all rhetoric. How do we make this practical?
Well, there it is, isn't it? It needs to be practical. And the question I'm always asking is, does this grow corn? Because if it doesn't grow any corn, I'm not particularly interested in it. I mean, it's interesting from a philosophical, spiritual place, and as a philosophical and spiritual woman, I'm up for that. But how is this manifesting? How is what any person is thinking about or doing manifesting in the world that we can say yes to? Because when I can say yes to what I see you doing, then that's leadership. It's different from a let's all get together and think, and we need to. Right? Because I think that many of our politicians don't do much of that, or our leaders don't do much of that. That part about reflection and thinking. We need to do that, but in service of what?
Yeah.
And,
there's a phrase I used to hear back in the 60s that used to make me crazy even back then, and it was, if only everybody would.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
I know what you're talking about.
You have to be at a certain age, I guess, to remember how big that was. But right. It was like, if only everybody would, fill in the blank. It sounds to me, Akaya Windwood, like you're changing the paradigm to, okay, now it's time for you to
fill in the blank. Absolutely. You know what? I mean, Tom, seriously, we've got to get to work here. And if we're not working, and I don't mean just getting a shitty ass job.
That's okay.
It's about saying I deserve, and I deserve more than what corporate America is saying that it will offer me.
Yeah.
I deserve a rightful place in this world and employment and that allows my gift to come into manifestation. And I'm going to take responsibility for it. Now, I don't want to pretend that we've got an even playing field here either, right?
Sure.
We know that historically there have been many people who have been disenfranchised from the systems that exist. But I think that even even in that context, there is an obligation on each of our parts to say, here's what I'm about, and here's what I'm going to do about that.
Right. Yeah. And those are the steps that we need to be taking. Akaya Windwood, the rockwoodleadership.org, the website, our pioneer guest for the day, pioneers.org. Akaya, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program, where reason is our lifestyle choice. We'll be right back.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartmann.
I am the egghead. I'm the commander. I'm the decider. Cuckoo, choo.
I'm the decider, and I decide what is best, and what's best is for Don Rumsfeld to remain as the Secretary of Defense.
Sitting in a White House garden, talking to the Lord. But my thoughts would be busy, busy hatching if I only had a brain.
I am the egghead. I'm the commander. I'm the decider.
Isn't it reassuring that the decider is there, making decisions? Welcome back to the pill that will help you escape the matrix, the Tom Hartmann radio program. Drop into our live chat room at tomhartmann.com if you would like. Our toll-free telephone number all across the U.S. of A. Actually, I think it works pretty much all around the world. 1-866-440-TOM, 440-THOM, or 440-8466. Justin in Lincoln, Nebraska. Hey, Justin, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm just pretty much convinced that the only thing that I can do is go door-to-door with, like, the Tom Hartmann newsletter or something.
Find a good political candidate who's saying the same things I am, Justin, and go door-to-door for them.
Well, here in Nebraska, I mean...
There are progressives in Nebraska.
There really isn't any good political candidates.
Well, in that case, then show up for the Democratic Party meeting or the Green Party meeting
I wish I could just take the transcripts from your show and just go door to door and hand them out.
Yeah. Well, there are archives over at whiterosesociety.org, and we have them on our website, and you're welcome to point people out to them. But that's not really what you called about, was it, Justin?
Well, actually, it was, because I'm tired of arguing with conservatives and just being called a liar and then not having, you know, the evidence right there in front of me to show them.
Yeah. Well, there's some excellent websites to back up the stuff. Let me just quickly commend to you a couple of them. ThinkProgress.org is a great blog with the news of the day. MediaMatters.org, a great website. MakeThemAccountable.com. I believe it is. It might be .org. I may be wrong on that. Carolyn Kay's website. BuzzFlash.com. OpEdNews.com. CommonDreams.org. These are all extraordinary websites. TheTruthOut.org. Alternet.org. There really isn't a shortage of good progressive blogs and websites and news sources that can give you the ammunition that you need to win the water cooler wars, Justin.
Well, do you know of a newsletter that I could, like, print off and just go door-to-door and hand out?
Well, what you may find, if you just, for example, just take commondreams.org, for example. If you just start reading every day, they publish 8 or 10 articles, 8 or 10 op-eds every day. And I would guess that pretty much once or twice a day there's something on there that I think is cool enough that I want to share with my listeners or that I would, you know, want to go door-to-door with, as it were. The problem is if you do it too much, I mean, you know, your neighbors are not going to take all that kindly to you showing up on their doorstep too often. But the equivalent of going door to door is forwarding messages to friends. I mean, it's just, you know, step by step. I really applaud the idea that, you know, kind of particularly following our last guest who talked about getting out there and doing what motivates you, that you want to do something. I would strongly suggest that you show up at the Democratic Party, at your local Democratic Party meeting.
Okay.
Can you do that?
Yeah, I can. Well, I just hope that everybody in the in the states where it's, the elections are a little bit closer, I hope people there do go door to door.
Yeah. Well, and I do too, Justin. But check out your, you're there in Nebraska, and check out your local Democratic Party in Lincoln, and, you know, citywide, countywide, whatever it may be. Go to one of their meetings, and then, you know, give us a call back in a month or so after you've done it, and let us know what you discovered.
Okay.
Would you?
Yep.
Great. Thanks a lot. I'd love to hear back on that and the follow-up on that, because occasionally we have people who really discover some really cool stuff, and sometimes they discover some really grim stuff, and they decide to stick around and make some real significant changes. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WPTT. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Good morning, Tom.
Morning.
I've decided along with a lot of the American, a good number of American people, that the president sounds strong, but he's wrong. Wrong across the board, just about. So anyway, remember when James Carville, I'm sure you do, said that in the 1910, it's the economy, stupid?
Right. That was Clinton's campaign slogan in 1990.
Yeah. Well, and I'm going to, let me bounce this off you and tell me what you think. I think today in America, and I said before that I thought it's too much about money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it is about money when you really get down to it. A lot of these problems,
sure.
It's about money.
Because money in our society, money defines security and safety. Money, because we don't have, you know, community the way that we have had at various times in the past. Money defines the ability to get health care, so it literally determines life and death. I mean, money is really important stuff in this society.
Well, you put it very well. That was very well spoken. The point I'm hopefully I can make here is that I think with these elections coming up in 06 and 08, especially in 06 though, that the stock market could be the wild card, because I expect a break in the market. I don't know if it'll be up or down. It may be down.
No, it's. But I think you're,
it could be a big wild card.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Gary, and I think it's going to break down. In fact, it is today. But you know, who knows? I mean, that could last a day. But I just, you know, it's just all the fundamentals are just absolutely unsustainable. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin.
You're listening to the Tom Harpin Program.
Why don't we live a race? These United States, we're the ones who need it worse. Let the rest of the world help us for change, and let's rebuild America first. Our highways and bridges are falling apart. Who's blessed? Who has been cursed? There's things to be done all over the world, but let's rebuild America first.
You tell them, Merle Haggard. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour of the Tom Harpin radio program. Truth in broadcasting for a change. Crushing news out of Uganda last week. This is personal for me. I've spent a fair amount of time in Uganda back in the early 1980s, when the biggest problem there then was not AIDS, but was famine as a consequence of the 1979-1980 war of liberation. It was referred to by the folks who came in to drive out Idi Amin, and he and his troops fled north through the Katamoja region, the Tanzanians coming in from the south. An army made up mostly of teenagers, driving Idi Amin and about 10,000 of his soldiers up through the north, through the Sudan, and up into Saudi Arabia, where he lived in a palace with his multiple—I forget how many wives he had, 20 some odd wives and children—for the rest of his days, because he, one of his last acts in his last year of office was to officially convert Uganda to Islam. Although that would be news to anybody in Uganda. Well, in any case, Uganda was one of the HIV success stories in the world. Throughout the 1990s, they had an HIV rate in the early 1990s when Bill Clinton came into office of around 15%, one of the places where the AIDS epidemic was really exploding in Uganda. And with just in a really extraordinary, aggressive message of use condoms, don't have sex with a lot of people, you know, be monogamous. Don't, if you're young, don't have, you know, don't have sex until you get married. Use condoms, and, you know, I mean, just, and making condoms widely available. By 2001, the year that George W. Bush came into office, the infection rate of HIV was down to 5% in Uganda. It was one of the most conspicuous success stories in all of Africa. The Bush administration came in and said, what? Well, here, this Esther Kaplan, writing about this over at talktoaction.org. She said, but conservative evangelicals rewrote this history with the full-throated cooperation of Uganda's evangelical first family, the Musevenis. As one Family Research Council paper put it, quote, both abstinence and monogamy helped to curb the spread of AIDS in Uganda. How did this happen? Shortly after he came to office in 1986, President Museveni of Uganda spearheaded a mass education campaign promoting a three-pronged AIDS prevention message, abstinence from sexual activity until marriage, monogamy within marriage, and condoms as a last resort. The message commonly became known as ABC, abstain, be faithful, and use condoms. But Washington decided to take the C out. As Secretary of State Colin Powell, who was in favor of passing out condoms in Africa, James Dobson goes after him. He says, Secretary Powell seems to be ignorant of the fact that Uganda has made great progress against AIDS by emphasizing abstinence, not condoms. Well, that was a lie from James Dobson, which shouldn't surprise you. James Dobson is not a Christian, by my definitions, anyway. Soon, players connected to the Christian right, from Franklin Graham's Samaritan's Purse to Anita Smith's Children's Aid Fund, cashed in to the tune of millions of dollars in federal grants from the Bush administration to spread the message of abstinence in Uganda. This was going to be the Christian right's new showcase. They were going to prove, get rid of condoms, and you can still have a reduction in AIDS rates. They even overruled the head of the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, overruled the experts, and funded a program that was an abstinence-only program, no condoms, last 5 years. Anita Smith, by the way, you know, one of these pushing this, close ally of Tom Coburn, the Oklahoma Senator James Dobson, helped get elected. He's so fanatically pro-abstinence, he's pushed for warning labels on condoms. You know, like, warning, this may break. Once demanded the ouster of the head of the Centers for Disease Control for promoting condom use. His legislative director, Roland Foster, used to regularly send out Children's AIDS Fund emails trashing HIV prevention organizations for being too sexually explicit and wanting them investigated and defunded. Many of them were under the Bush administration. So here, Coburn, former congressman, when he got elected to the Senate in 2004, President Bush picked Smith, Anita Smith, his close ally, to be the head of his Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS. And they're taking this real seriously, the Bushies. Right? They've got, you know, just as an indication, Bush's daughter, Barbara Bush, and her party playmate, Maggie Betts, they're senior advisors on this council. This faith-based initiative that the federal government is spending millions of dollars on, basically giving it to right-wing Christian groups to go over to Uganda and preach abstinence. Well, the results are in. The results are in. They've been doing it for 4 years now, and here it is. The Bush administration's $1 billion experiment in using abstinence messages as the basis of HIV prevention has borne its first fruit. In a public speech, this is from Esther Kaplan's column, in a public speech on May 18th, Uganda's AIDS commissioner, Kwihumuro Apuli, announced that HIV infections have almost doubled in Uganda over the past 2 years. from 70,000 in 2003 to 130,000 in 2005. Doubled in 2 years since the Bush administration withdrew the condoms. And despite, writes Esther Kaplan, despite this chilling wake-up call, Bush has empowered Christian right activists to continue to push their abstinence-only agenda at a UN special session on HIV/AIDS, which is happening right now. This is such a tragedy. I mean, these abstinence advocates, they're pushing phony science. You got phony science, New York socialites, professional evangelizers, and Bush's daughter and her drinking buddy. That's who we're sending to the United Nations. And in the meantime, millions of people are dying. This is head of presidential mission, First Lady Laura Bush, head of delegation, Ambassador John R. Bolton. It's just, oh man, the last time I was in Uganda was 83, I think. I have friends who are in Uganda right now as we speak. Miss Barbara Bush, Washington, D.C. Well, Bill Gates is a co-chair. Oh, co-chair of the Gates Foundation. Bill Gates is on the commission. Bill Gates has a fairly level head on these issues. Hopefully he'll bring something to this. This is just so sad to get this information. In the meantime, speaking of abstinence, Howard Dean, Chris Matthews, he really wants to know about the Clinton sex life. I mean, this they want to make this thing into a political issue, and Howard Dean having nothing to do with it. He was on Hardball a few weeks ago, just laying it out.
The New York Times at the top of the page, the front page, ran a big story on Bill and Hillary Clinton, and it led with the question of this. When the subject of Bill and Hillary Clinton comes up for many prominent Democrats these days, topic A is the state of their marriage. Is that a true statement?
Yeah. Chris Matthews. We don't want to talk about how the Bushies are destroying the American economy. We don't want to talk about Republican corruption. We want to know if Bill and Hillary are sleeping together often enough.
No, I think that's ridiculous. That's just gossip, and I would expect that to be in the New York Post, not the New York Times.
But we got to have gossip after all. This is TV news. We call it news anyway.
Let me read you something from a man I know you respect, David Broder, The Washington Post. Quote, in today's column, the very fact that the New York Times has sent a reporter out to interview 50 people about the state of the Clintons' marriage and placed the story on the top of page one was a clear signal, if any was needed, that the drama of the Clinton's personal life would be a hot topic if she runs for president. Is that a fair statement?
In other words, we in the press, we're really going to beat this one all over the place.
I think that's also gossip. Listen, I'm not
no pun intended.
Be tough on this stuff. I think gossip and silliness like that, in the long run, do not overcome the fact that somebody's got to do something about gas prices, that we've sent a ton of jobs to China, that we have a budget that's so far out of balance that our kids are in debt.
Don't go there.
Those are the issues that matter, not salacious gossip, and I don't care who writes it. I have a lot of respect for David Broder and the New York Times. It's still gossip.
It's still gossip. You can tell Chris Matthews, oh, no, what, are you going to talk about serious issues? No, 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 we want to talk about the Clinton sex life. Yeah, or their love life, let's say, their marriage. I'm sorry, I frankly don't care. You know, Hillary could be a nun. I mean, I want to know what the policies are. What are they going to do? What, you know, where do they stand on the issues? 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Forgotten flag and country and all it signifies. Across a foreign land he fought, too young to question why. Forgotten flag and country, as precious as a prayer. He didn't know the thing about the fools who sent him there.
And welcome back. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. Get the latest iPods and all things Macintosh, and the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, 1-888-ECOWINE. Our telephone number, toll-free all across the United States, 1-866-440-8466. And Sally in Portland, Oregon on the line. Hey, Sally, what's up?
Yeah, I wanted to just bring up another little part of what you were talking about earlier with the Supreme Court's swaying over toward more conservative views. There's been a revolving door, I'm sure you're aware, between people working for large corporations and then shuttling over to working for the government agencies.
Yeah, like John Roberts, for example.
Pardon?
Like John Roberts, for example.
Yes. Or like Clarence Thomas, for another example, being chief counsel for Monsanto and then going into the Supreme Court and then the 5-4 decision allowing corporations to patent life.
Right.
And the Pandora's box that's opened as far as farmers being sued for genetically engineered seed drifting over and contaminating their fields and patent infringement that happens after that. And the buying up of the seed companies and the allowing of all of the people being unaware that what they're eating has any genetically modified products in it because of the banning of the labeling of such.
Yep. Good point, Sally. Good point. Thank you.
Bye.
You're welcome. Good to hear from you. Ken in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Well, I feel like there is this rope tightening around all our throats. I mean, I lost my job, so, you know, it goes overseas. Now I'm making some money online. They want to take that away. Now they want to make us poor, they want to make us hungry, and then they want to take away all our escapes. No sex, no drinks, no drugs. What are they going to do, slam us up against the wall until we lash out at them? Is this, do they think we're just going to bend over and keep taking this?
I think that they, you know, in to give a serious answer to yours, I'm sure that there's, you know, your question is actually serious under the facetious comment. I think that what you're looking at, if you go back and you look at the history of the neoconservative movement in the United States, or for that matter, the conservative movement in the United States, the modern conservative movement, which bears no resemblance to Dwight Eisenhower's form of conservatism. And for that matter, even very little resemblance to Barry Goldwater's form of conservatism. If you go back and look at it, you see that it comes out of their response to a strong middle class. We had, in the 1960s and the 1970s, over a 20-year period, we had the strongest middle class in the world, or certainly one of the strongest middle classes in the world. There are some folks who would argue that there were a few European countries that were doing about as well as we were. And what did that produce? That produced people who were willing to say to their government, no. It produced kids who were sufficiently confident that they could always get into a school, and even if they didn't make it all the way through college, they could always get a job because the economy was strong and there was a lot of money floating around, and they had a strong social safety net in just friends and family, if nothing else, because the middle class was so wealthy, broadly speaking. It produced kids who were willing to speak up and stand up and speak out on college campuses. It produced women and people of color saying, we're not going to take this anymore. We want our rights. That's what it produced. And it produced, you know, and the conservatives are watching going, whoa, you know, cities are burning. Students are rioting. This is the end of society as we know it. This is what happens when you have a strong middle class. We can't have that. And they began with the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980. And it really wasn't a secret to the conservatives on the inside. In fact, it really wasn't a secret to anybody who just read the newspapers. They began deconstructing the American middle class, taking away unions, which is one of the main things that helped build the middle class, taking away the rights to speak out, increasing police powers incrementally, step by step, you know, progressively, and creating a big brother society that would be more stable. You got to understand, Ken, these guys value stability above all else. And by and large, they have their security. We're talking a ruling elite, a conservative ruling elite that is, you know, everywhere from the middle class to the extremely wealthy. And they're not, yeah, the bottom line is what you're experiencing is exactly what they want.
Yeah, well, France in 1798 was real stable, wasn't it?
I'm sorry, say it again.
France in 1798 was real stable.
Well, see, that's the point. You go back to 1814, and in part because of the French Revolution, which had happened just, you know, two decades earlier, in 1814, you had David Ricardo writing about the Iron Law of Wages, and he pointed out that when you have labor in surplus of the number of jobs available, that the price of labor will fall to what he called subsistence levels. And what happened in the French Revolution, and some argue that it was the result of the little ice age, you know, the weather was so bad. I would say that it was probably more the economic policies of Louis and what's-her-name, that you had people who were no longer able to subsist. I mean, you had bread riots in France in 1797, was it? And so we're not there yet. I mean, the question that you asked behind the question of are we to the point where people are going to rebel, where you're going to have, like, the French Revolution, people standing up in the streets and saying, you know, hell no, I'm not going to. I don't think so. I don't think that we're at that point yet. And I think that they know that. They know where that point is, and they're not going to push beyond it. But I'm telling you, they do not want a strong middle class. That's why they're so aggressively opposed to unions and really any form of democracy. Ken, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. It's good to hear from you. 56 minutes past the hour. Coming up tomorrow's program, I'll be asking conservative Yaron Brook, why destroy the Arctic tundra for oil industry profits? Jeffrey Feldman from Frame Shop is Open is going to drop by. Larry Scott, VA Watchdog, the data heist, what's going on with that? That and more in your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it!
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.